Welcome to Book It,
a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books. Book It is hosted by the Blue Manatee Literacy Project,
a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio.
When you shop with Blue Manatee, you are giving back to the community. For every book purchased, BMLP donates a book to a child in need.
Book It is hosted by me, Michael Woodson.
And me, Jill Burkett-Ragacy. Hey, Michael.
Hi, Jill.
I'm excited to talk to you today.
Oh, me too. I really, really, really need it today.
Yes. I have a great story for you to kick things off today.
Yes. Tell me right away.
It has come to my attention. My husband was looking for a book to read. And, you know, he's not a huge reader, so I was a little bit surprised.
Yeah, I'm proud of him.
And I was like, I feel like I give you books and you don't like them or you don't read them. Like, you should just pick a book. Don't involve me in this process. Right. Like,
I'm out.
Right? I don't want to do your reader's advisory. And then he says to me, every book I've read as an adult, you have recommended to me.
How do we, like, award, give you whatever award you deserve?
Yeah, you think that for a hot second. And then, if you're me, because you've lived this, you go, what are you talking about?
Oh, sure.
And he goes, all the books I've read, you recommended. Harry Potter, The Da Vinci Code, Racing in the Rain, The Cosmos. You recommended them all. Four books, Michael. I've recommended four books to him.
In his entire adult life.
Yes. And this list. I mean, clearly I was digging deep. Harry Potter, right. The Da Vinci Code, Racing in the Rain, and The Cosmos by Carl Sagan.
I really want him to start like a Goodreads account, and those are the only four books
just
listed.
Those four.
And just never, ever updates it.
Also, by the way, given these four books, what in the world do you recommend to this person?
Exactly. There's what's the thread here?
I have no idea.
I mean, silver lining is that Racing the Rain now is a movie with Milo.
That's true. And I do enjoy him.
Yes, I like looking at him.
Yes. What are we talking about today?
Oh, well, I was thinking in the body of this episode, you know, we've released an episode about memoirs, and memoirs are a form of nonfiction. And Jill, you're a big fan of memoirs, and I've read a few, not nearly as much as you. But nonfiction in general is a genre of writing that I am so intimidated by, and I always have been, and not something we really talk about very often on this podcast because we're mostly fiction readers. But I was curious about what is your relationship with nonfiction? And also, like, you have young ones. Are they reading nonfiction?
Yeah, this is so interesting to me because as we discussed when we talked about memoirs, I didn't realize I liked them until I realized it was like 30% of what I read.
And recommend.
Right. But I will say that is a lot of where my nonfiction reading comes in.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is a perception problem because like when I think about nonfiction, I think because I do the book ordering, I think about the slew of political books. Like, I mean, I feel like we get like three books a week about Trump or anyone else, really. And it just feels like really overwhelming. And I don't want to read about that.
Right.
Just that's such a small segment of like what's available. And I feel like I'm probably doing myself a disservice because every time I branch out of that, I'm almost always happy with the results.
Right.
I don't know. I think I need to be better about it. I will say my kids are amazing readers of nonfiction. And here's why. When they came through in the Obama administration and did Common Core, which I know people are on all sides about, and there are things I like about it and things that I don't.
Sure, like anything.
Yeah. One of the things in Common Core is that depending on your grade level, but nonfiction reading is a segment of your required reading at every grade level. And so the kids are reading nonfiction all the time now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's fantastic. They are constantly reading books about plants and animals and people, and it's a huge variety of nonfiction texts. And I think we've seen a reaction to it in publishing because now we have all these picture book biographies and like really pretty nonfiction that we really didn't have before, like ever. 8 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It just didn't look like it looks now.
Totally.
And there has been more nonfiction published for kids since this went into place. And it's just, it's higher quality. It's more accessible. It's pretty. You want, it's inviting. You want to engage in it.
I think that so much of the nonfiction that we as adults consume all of the time is because of the way that we consume news now. And it's never ending. And I feel really intimidated by nonfiction, but I also feel like more than ever, the concept of fiction as an escape from endless nonfiction in my life. But to your point, like in looking back on childhood and my reading habits growing up, like I never read nonfiction and it was so intimidating to me. And as an adult, I think that has had an effect on the kinds of books I think are just too smart for me. Like I'm not smart enough to read them. And I think that's why I was so excited for us to talk to Blair Amani, who's the interview around this episode. And she's written two nonfiction books, but the one we talked to her about is so approachable in a lot of unique ways.
Yeah, I'm excited for people to hear this interview with Blair. She is interesting and dynamic as a person. And her writing reflects who she is as a person. And it immediately captures your attention and pulls you in to read the content, which is also really good.
Yeah, the content is so good. And talking to her about it, really, I couldn't quite figure out what about it was so memorable necessarily. Like something was sticking with me about it. And I was like, I don't know what it is. But then talking to her about it, and I don't want to say because I want people to hear her say it, it makes so much sense. And I'm just really excited about kids getting to read it and even adults getting to read it.
Absolutely. Should we play the interview?
Yeah. And just before we get going into it, this interview is being brought to you by the Ringer app. And Ringer is an amazing platform for us to use. We're still in quarantine in some ways. And throughout this pandemic, it's been a really lovely way for us to be able to bring you interviews from really interesting authors and illustrators. However, you will hear a very slight audio difference from our conversations around the interview. So thank you for sticking with us through it. And here's that interview. All right. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Book It. For anyone who is new here, new listeners, I am Michael. I use he, him, and his pronouns.
I am Jill. I use she, her pronouns. And we are really excited today to be joined by Blair Amani. Blair is a critically acclaimed historian, outspoken advocate and activist, and a really dynamic speaker. She is the author of two nonfiction books, Modern Herstory, Stories of Women and Non-Binary People Rewriting History, that came out in 2018. And her latest book, Making Our Way Home, The Great Migration and the Black American Dream. Welcome, Blair.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me. And I'm excited about this too. Let's book it.
Michael and I, well, and the whole staff, we fell in love with making Our Way Home when it arrived in the store. I picked it up initially because the package was so pretty.
Yes, I
opened it. Yes, I opened it and we just fell in love. And so I was wondering if you could give our listeners kind of a brief overview of the book and anything that is special about it that you just wanted to share.
Absolutely. So there's so many parts of this book. The cover is definitely how I try to get my way into people's minds and homes. Mm. The illustration on the front cover is by Rochelle Baker, who does all the illustrations in the text. And it's actually an adaptation of a family photo of ours, where my great aunt and uncle Clarence and Carmen, who are standing in the middle, were walking through Harlem in their Sunday best. And my great aunt Carmen, she was a model. And so she had one of her photographer buddies come and do the photo for them. Turns into an iconic family photo. And I decided to remix it a little bit. We didn't know who two of the people in the photo were. So we were like, okay, let's get rid of them. And so instead I put myself and my partner Akeem, my fiance Akeem. And then my uncle Lester, who we knew was gay because he came out later in life, we decided to nix the lady that he was with because she was just kind of, we didn't know like who she was, and it wasn't as though we were erasing anybody. But we decided to instead add to it and say, you know, here's a partner for Uncle Lester, because he deserved to live his gay best life as a Black man, even though he was prevented from doing that by homophobia, by racism. So in that way, it represents the Black past as it should have been, the Black past as it was, and then Black futures. And it's really exciting because I've had such, it's just been so exciting to see how people receive from the book. You know, some people see the representation immediately of a gay couple on the cover, like my brother, who himself is gay. Other people pick up the book, read it, and then come to me confused why it's so queer affirming, despite the fact that there's a gay couple on the front. But as far as the synopsis, as you asked, so in American history, as I was taught it, Black folks are such a footnote, which is an embarrassment, where we are, you know, we show up as enslaved people, as enslaved Africans, then we disappear. Then we show back up again with Martin Luther King and we get free. And that is such a one-sided, one-dimensional view of Black history. But if that's what you learn, then when you see the Black Lives Matter movement, when you see mass incarceration, then there's this cognitive dissonance where it's like, well, Black folks were fine. We didn't learn anything bad. Indigenous folks were fine. We didn't learn anything bad. Women were fine. Yeah. You know, women got equality during the 19th Amendment. What are you talking about? Instead of acknowledging the fact that Indigenous women weren't even considered citizens, even though the land was first stewarded by them. So I wanted to, you know, pull back the curtain and really say, this is what happened. And I did it in a very intentional way where I made sure not to depict suffering. We can get into that further later. But it covers the Great Migration as its main, you know, kind of North Star, which is the period of time where, due to domestic terrorism through the Ku Klux Klan, through job losses, through, you know, climate changes from unsustainable farming practices by settlers, Black folks had to move from rural areas where we were trapped during enslavement to industrial areas like Chicago, Oakland, Baltimore, Detroit, etc., and Cincinnati. I know y'all are in Ohio. And so that story is so crucial. 6 million people moved. And that's why so many folks who you find in these areas have roots in the South. And so I wanted to make it a story about internal migration, because oftentimes in America, we idolize the immigrant story and then we erase people who have been, you know, subjugated under white supremacy, like Black folks, like Indigenous folks. So I was like, hey, here's our story, too.
Gosh, that is so interesting. And actually, to your point, on Mondays, Jill on our Instagram, she does book recommendations. And I think maybe like a month ago, she recommended Making Our Way Home, and she mentioned how it's geared toward older children and teenagers, but that it has really major crossover potential for adults as well. And having read it, I really agree with that. But I'm curious about your perspective on that, because I think to your point, part of why it has such crossover potential is that so many history classes growing up have failed us, and that this was the first time I was reading about so many of these people. And it made me frustrated, like maybe in a good way, like practical anger. And I'm just curious about what you hope kids get from this in reading this, or teenagers get from this, from reading this, who may have never heard of some of these people before.
Definitely. And Michael, I think what you're experiencing is the sense of Apple Care told me, but in historical sense, where it's like, what? History class told me.
Yeah.
And then you become highly upset because you realize Apple Care or history in this class lied. And so you have a tantrum. Or in my case, you write a book, you know, or you just pass it on to other people to move forward. You use that righteous anger.
Yeah.
So I actually didn't characterize the book as YA. That actually happened on the publishing side. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a longer conversation about how sometimes publishing houses decide they know what's best. I say I wrote it was going to write it at a fifth grade level, but that's because most Americans read at a fifth grade level, which is fine. You know, it does speak to the fact that we don't spend enough money in education. Our teachers are underpaid, especially now with the pandemic. So many students can't access education because they don't have internet access. Meanwhile, in other countries that we look down upon, with our hubris as Americans, not us in particular, but, you know, us, you know, like Mexico are using public access television to educate people on a mass scale, which is much more higher retention. So there's so many things at play. But most Americans read at a fifth grade level. But there's also this interesting thing that happens where folks who have been able to access academia or access higher learning have a bias towards what educational materials should look like, that it should be hard to read, that you should have to read the same scholarly article that you paid $40 for three times to grasp the sense of it when it could be written in plain English. You know, I have this, the book, The Guide to Concise Writing, but also I think using Twitter, using Instagram, being forced to microblog important conversations and condense it into smaller, more tangible pieces has really helped my writing style. But there's so much stuff that people can learn. You can have academic rigor and still have it be easy to read and consume. And that's kind of my whole style now. You know, I do that type of thing on social media with Smarter in Seconds. And it's so funny because I'll have like PhD students. Actually, one of my friends, Leah Neiman, she's a PhD student and she's going to be citing one of my Instagram lessons in her papers. And I'm like, wow.
No way.
You know, like this has mass appeal because you know, education is relevant no matter where you're at, if you haven't learned it before.
Mm-hmm. I'm like momentarily speechless because I can't decide where I want to go next. I just identify so much with that. Michael and I are often talking because we read widely for work and for the podcast. And I feel like so many times I'm talking about how I started reading a genre or a writer or someone from a specific region. And I'm always like, oh, well, I was introduced to this concept when I was in college and I learned that everything, I was a history major, I learned everything I knew about South America was wrong. It's everything you're saying is just speaking so deeply to me. And I originally came across your first book, Modern History, because the galley came into the store and I brought it home. And my daughter, who's 12, I can't keep any of my books away from her. She reads insane. And reading about women is like her jam. And it kept disappearing from my office. And I said, oh, do you like this? And she was like, oh, Mom, all these women are amazing. Like, and I,
come on, Mom.
I know, get with it, Mom. I liked the book. She liked the book. And the crossover, I think, is so interesting because it was both of us were learning about people we were unfamiliar with. It was the apple here lied to us, as you've said. But the package makes it great. And I love also that you take this approach where like nothing is black and white. We all live in the gray area. And there are so many aspects of history. The one that I kept coming back to was like the Civilian Conservation Corps during the Great Depression, where like, did it do good things? Sure. Can we spend some time talking about all the stuff that wasn't good that nobody ever hears about? And I just love that you're unpacking the gray area and shining the light on it.
Something else too, and I think this is interesting, when you talked about your writing style and how social media has really helped sort of like these micro lessons. And Jill and I are obsessed with your Instagram.
Smarter in Seconds?
Yes, Smarter in Seconds. Yeah. We're obsessed with it. And I think because, if I can swear, it kind of like forces us to remove all the bullshit and just like, this is what we should be doing here. I'm teaching you how easy it is to do it. And I think that, can you talk a little bit about your writing style, a little bit more about that and how the less is more quality has really impacted the work you do?
Sure. So the first thing I want to do though is like preview for you my next Smarter in Seconds that I'm filming today, actually.
Please.
It's a little song because I was listening to Johnny Cash and, you know, iconic. And it's kind of, you know, I'm not the best singer, but I can definitely do a Southern situation, a little musical country style. So anyway, so I did a post about cultural appropriation and I was like, well, how can I take pieces of this and put it into 15 seconds in my Smarter in Seconds style? So here we go. You may have learned that cowboys were white, but that's just not the truth. Buckaroo comes from the Spanish word vaquero. And vaqueros were Mexican cowboys. The end. And you just learn something new. So I really like the idea that you can condense things. But I think that the reason why I make things so brief and why I'm so good at brevity and concision is because as a woman of color, as a Black woman, I'm always expecting to be interrupted because that is the state of the world. You know, we are told as marginalized people that we are taking up space unduly or that there's only one spot for a Black person, but there's, you know, 78 spots for white men and we have to all compete for that one spot instead of looking at the array and saying, hey, are all these white dudes like qualified? Is it that talent and intelligence is only coming in white bodies, or is it that access only is afforded to those people? It's the second one, right, by the way. And so it's come from a variety of different places, but also that because of this, you know, I've been thinking about things like the nap ministry, which is, you know, revolutionarily and radically taking back the idea of taking a nap, taking a break in a world that places so much emphasis on our capital, our time, and to say, hey, you know, we have to take a moment. But I've also been thinking about how that's impacted my life, how I have felt so rushed through so many things that I could have luxuriated on. And so it's made me a fast talker, somebody who's able to get points across quickly, because I'm anticipating that I will be shushed or you're shut down, whether that's in the workplace, at school, etc. So I'm flipped that and said, hey, now that Reels is out and it literally takes 15 seconds, let me use this ability that I've gotten through my own experience, my lived experience, but also growing up when AIM chat rooms where everything was abbreviated, right, and figure out how I can take complex lessons and shorten it. And it's stretched everything from like, how do you ask about pronouns, to how you shouldn't talk to people about their weight or size, and has so many applications. And it's just the relatability that a lot of people are going through the same bullshit, and we have to navigate it. And so whether that's somebody else already covering it, or just feeling validated, I think that's why it resonates. But it's gotten like, I think, 15 million views across the board. So it's done way better than I thought it might.
Yeah. Do you have plans with it beyond, like, do you have any hopes for it to, because it is wildly popular and successful. Are there ways that you want to adapt in any way?
Oh, totally. I think that there's like monetization potential for this. Like I could do something, you know, that's an interesting thing as well. Like using companies to fund my educational programs. Like how is that any different from a grant program funding a research project? You know, like Pfizer can still fund a research study that biases towards them, but it's all about the researcher and the integrity. So in the same way, you can use influencing in those same regard. It doesn't mean that everybody's going to be scrupulous, but it means that there's potential for good and potential for fuckery. And so recently I did a video with my partner, my fiance Akeem, about clear conversations about relationships. And it was sponsored by Clean and Clear. And we use Clean and Clear products. And I was happy to do it because they removed microplastics from their use. They're donating money to LGBTQ people and hiring Black and LGBTQ people. And so it was great. And we got to pay the rent. And also educate folks. So it's melding these worlds. As far as Smarter in Seconds, there's so many different applications for that. You know, like I wear hats in it. Like I have this one beautiful yellow fedora that was just made for me by Mad Patty Hat Co. in Maine. And I'm like, okay, well, if you liked my hat or my eyeshadow, here's where I got it from, you know? So that's the one type of thing. And then also it could be brought to you by XYZ. Maybe JPL or NASA wants to, you know, pay me a couple $100 or 1,000, I don't know what their budget is, to educate folks about solar flares in 15 seconds. I'm happy to do it. And it would just be, this Smarter in Seconds is brought to you by NASA. Solar flares are da-da-da-da-da. But beyond that, I think that it's a great way for me to grow my platform, because a lot of people just know me for Smarter in Seconds, and then they go, oh, and you write books too? So it's fun.
I'm not sure if it's last week or it was this week. You did one about when is it okay to ask people when they're having children. And as a person who had children 10 years into my marriage, I was like, I want to put it on an iPad and wear it around my neck, like go back in time. And I'm curious how you select your topics, both the specific people or events that are profiled in your book or in your Smarter in Seconds series. There's so much to cover, and I'm just curious what that process looks like.
Yeah.
Sure. So I try to be very intentional about everything that I do. So the first thing that comes to me is, you know, what I'm interested in. And of course, that's based on my own biography, just like all of us are. You know, you're going to gravitate to the people who are most like you or that inform your experiences in a way that validates who you are or what you've known. So to check that, I also make sure to, like for Modern Herstory and for Making Our Way Home, to create a matrix where I had like a list of recommendations, but also was tracking along demographic lines, you know, culture lines, etc., who I was including. I grew up as a Black Baptist. I'm Muslim today, but because of my story being informed by that, I was over-indexing for Black Christian figures. And so I was like, oh, okay, so that makes sense. Let's correct. And so then you have to correct by also looking into different religious figures across diversity. Because it's one thing to say, oh yeah, there's totally diversity within the Black Christian community, but also let's make sure that we're giving shine to everybody. So as far as my books, that's how I try to look at things, not just stuff that's interesting to me, some stuff that is interesting to me because I'm the one writing it, but to make sure that I'm not relying too much on gatekeeping and keeping others out. And so in that way, I hire folks to read my books, to, you know, provide their own perspectives, interview a wide range of researchers, but then also to consider who is a researcher, who's an educator, who's an expert. That doesn't always look like somebody with a PhD. It doesn't always look like somebody who's published. It looks like somebody who's been doing the work for longer than you generally, but it also means doing innovative types of work. It might be somebody who has a robust TikTok following. It might be somebody who creates curriculum creation. It's not always going to be McGraw-Hill. That's another big thing to consider. Who has the subject matter expertise? If I'm talking about, you know, lynchings, for example, and I talk about my grandma Verna Jean, who, you know, was affected by the lynching of Willie Keyes in 1936, she can tell me anecdotally what that was like in a way that no statistical paper can, in a way that, you know, is so raw. But then I can go on to the Equal Justice Initiative and look at their reports on lynching in America and cross-reference that anecdotal story with, you know, the facts of how many lynchings were there. What did that mean? If I have one story, just imagine what that looks like amplified. And then you start to add your own flair to it. As far as Smarter in Seconds goes, I have the benefit of a wide audience that's very responsive. So if I'm like, hey, what do y'all want to hear about? They will tell me. And they have great ideas always coming at me. But some stuff I have to decide I can't cover. Like recently I was like, oh, I can do a post on what you should do if you're in public and you want to tell somebody to fix their nose into their mask. I've tried it. I piloted it, you know, did some user testing, some A/B testing, as the tech folks would say. Didn't go well. So I'm not about to tell people to do something that doesn't work or could put them in danger. So it's about taking a step back. And I think it's also because I used to do crisis communications when I worked at Planned Parenthood. And that means looking at what could go wrong and preventing it. So making sure that you're not, you know, fooling yourself into believing everything you're offering into the world is positive, really thinking about how it could be used against the folks you're trying to help.
I love that. I had a sense before our conversation, just from your presentations, that you are always very thorough about how you approach things. And that's, I feel like that's true.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's just like important. I think that like, from your perspective too, maybe like, you're a historian by day, you know, and I think that like that innate want to be thorough and to do it right, makes the content that much more trustworthy, you know. Like I always trust what you're saying because you've clearly done the research and the practice to make sure that it's the most prepared it could possibly be.
I'm glad you do, because some people just happen upon my stuff and decide that I'm pulling it out of my butt and intentionally like being inaccurate.
I was going to ask you, because you're so, I think we're going the same so big.
You're so generous with the people who are unkind to you.
Awful.
And unkind is not doing it justice. People are terrible to you, and you're so kind about correcting them publicly. I'm always, I don't know. I would love to hear your take on it.
So the way I've been thinking about it recently, so in May, I had like 50,000 followers, and I had accumulated that over a period of like 4 years doing various work, being a public figure, speaking, doing campaigns, blah, blah, blah. Then when a bunch of people realized that racism was an issue worth learning about, I got 200,000, 250,000, and I'm at 282,000 at the time of recording. So I had to really understand, okay, I'm not going to change what I'm doing fundamentally. I might innovate, but I'm not going to suddenly become a new person, because I'm going to continue to give the people what they came here for. But also, this is like a good sized city. This is a good sized municipality, and I'm the mayor. This is Blairtown. So once I started thinking about that analogy, it makes a lot of sense when I have the odd person saying like, hey, y'all, this is my decree as Mayor Blair, and I'm going to call you all smarties. There's going to be like 10 people just statistically who are like, I don't want you to be naming us. I think that's a bad thing. Blah, 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 blah. Because it's 282,000 people. not baseless accounts, not internet bots, people. And people have opinions. Right. And opinions are like assholes. You know, they stink. No, I'm kidding. Opinions are good and critical thinking is good. And so I have always been raised to foster conversation, sure, but to do that in a respectful manner. So if somebody comes at me sideways, I will shut it down. I will block them because I deserve respect. But if somebody comes at me and it's in the gray area where maybe they're saying something, mm-hmm, not expecting me to respond because they don't view people with large followings as human beings like themselves, then I'll totally address that because it's going to help the next person that they, mm-hmm, interact with, and it'll help their own worldview. And that's kind of is how I try to look at it as a holistic educator. It doesn't always go well. Recently, I responded to a comment and I posted my response and it was kind of like this person had gone back and forth. I kind of felt like it was superfluous. Like, this is annoying. I'm going to, you know, put a little music over it with my reaction GIF, whatever. The person who had sent it was a 19-year-old college student who felt very targeted, even though I had removed their name. I can totally understand in like hindsight how that might have made them feel. Because I had also lost sight of the fact that these are actual people, you know, and that what it looks like in a power dynamic sense for them to be asking one person as a question with a private account versus me being like, hey, 200,000 people, look at this person and how they made me respond. So the person sent me a couple videos just like speaking from the heart, saying how much it hurt. And I saw like 2 seconds of the first video they sent me and I saw they were crying. And I was immediately like, here's my phone number. Let's FaceTime. I don't want anyone to ever feel bullied by me, especially because I'm anti-bullying, but also because my whole point on being here isn't to make people feel bad. It's to uplift, mm-hmm, people. So we talked. We have a great friendship now. And like, that's what I'm about. You know, I want to make sure that even if one person who I'll probably never meet in real life, who, you know, you have to be a good person, not because you're afraid of getting called out for being a bad person, but because you are a good person. And that's how I approach everything. I've also had to take reflection and say, okay, well, am I burnt out right now and in not a good place to respond to questions? That's fine. I'll respond later. They aren't going anywhere. So that way I can be the best person that I can be as I educate folks. Because the worst thing you have is when you have a grumpy teacher who keeps telling you to go look at the syllabus when you genuinely have questions and you lost the syllabus because it was 6 months ago.
That's giving me a lot more credit than I would deserve. I lose a syllabus within like an hour of getting it.
Whereas I have like all of my syllabuses like cataloged by
laminated. Yeah.
So Blair, this might be totally geeky, but I'm going to say it anyway. We talked about the package of your book and I was telling Michael, one of my favorite things about it is the glossary. Like, is it geeky to say I love the glossary?
No, it's great because I work so hard on it. And there's this thing in indexing and in organization called patronomics. When people are listed by the last name or their father's name in, you know, kind of Eurocentric environments. So we made sure, as like getting into really the minutia of how intentional I try to be. I didn't even know that was a thing. The indexer was like, this is a book about like women and non-binary people. It's pretty much not centering the patriarchy. Are you sure you want to center the patriarchy in the naming conventions? And I was like, no, thank you, indexer, whose name I wish I had remembered. I don't want to do that. Because that the glossary, I loved that part of history books because it made it so easy to do the notes when it was taught for a test. And so it made me think, okay, well, how can I add to this? How can I make it so somebody can buy an $18 textbook instead of having to spend $350 plus $150 course license key that the teacher never uses? So that way we can educate folks without them even having to go to college. And I felt like a glossary was a great part of it, but that was like writing a whole other book on itself, but it was worth it.
Yeah, I told Michael, I said I would buy this book just for, I mean, the whole book was amazing, but if the glossary was its own book, I would have bought that too.
Yay. But that's the thing. That's most of the stuff that I got. You know, there's this book. It's like Black American History A to Z. It was created in the 70s and it's full of bias. Like, I think this book, it was created by Black folks, but still there's bias about younger movements. And it was calling the founders of the Black Panther movement impatient youths. And I was like, okay, okay, boomers. Even though they were still talking about other boomers at that time. But, it's just so interesting to see, but so many of the books that I have growing up that had representation were like Black women A to Z. This thing, you know, alphabetized or in a glossary or in a dictionary or an encyclopedia. And I liked that part of it. And so I didn't want to take away what I liked. I wanted to add to it.
Mm-hmm.
It really shines through. I'm wondering also, because Making Our Way Home is such a beautiful visual experience, could you talk a little bit about what the process was working with Rochelle Baker? Was it collaborative, or did you deliver her or give her kind of a idea of what you had in mind?
So we were, of course, very intentional about this as well, because I think that's the best way when you're under a time crunch, which I often am, because I love procrastinating and I'm good at it. You know, I tend to get stuff done regardless. Some say it's a character flaw. Who knows? We'll find out. But when you are in a time crunch, which often happens with editing processes, it's really easy to get caught up in the minutiae, in like the the grammatical structure, the commas, and forget what your roadmap was. So when I advise people when they're writing book proposals or they're looking at like illustrations, to really have a roadmap. What is the goal? So earlier I was saying how I didn't want to duplicate trauma. A lot of books that cover Black history usually have images, they have diagrams, which are very dehumanizing, to look at the transatlantic slave trade as just a series of diagrams instead of human people who were, you know, forced in bondage and shackled to one another, instead of a nice and tidy little illustration used for trade purposes. Or you have the image of a Black man from the 1800s whose back is completely keloided over because he's been lashed so many times as an enslaved man. Both of those images both dehumanize and reinforce this idea that Black people should be subject to violence, or that's a natural state of Blackness. And so there are so many psychological consequences to this. And so I didn't want to have a body, you know, a lynched person in my book. I didn't want to have violent images of people getting attacked by police or by, you know, police dogs at a protest. I wanted to show moments of pride and of strength, not because I'm, you know, hiding away or ashamed of these other pieces, because it's an important part of the story, but it can be described, it can be illuminated without reinforcing what we know through child psychologists and through educational psychologists, reinforce the state that we are in. You don't want to reify the conditions of oppression while trying to educate people about it. So that's what Rochelle and I talked about. We were trying to figure out how we could depict lynching without doing those bad things. And so what we ended up deciding on was just illustrating a noose while also accompanying that with text that described what took place. Having things like moments of triumph, also not centering whiteness, meaning that I think Eleanor Roosevelt's the only white woman depicted in the text outright, who's like named and not a background character. Which is a nice flip to how it usually fears to be a Black person in those stories, but is also appropriate because it's a book about Black history. And then also thinking about how lightness and, you know, lighter skin is often prioritized even within the Black community. So we were going to have this beautiful illustration of Lena Horne to accompany the piece on colorism in the chapter 6 or 7. And I was thinking, hey, it's kind of colorism to spend so much time prioritizing her and her beauty instead of showing other people in the community who are also beautiful, who have browner hues. So that was a shift that we decided to make. And it was difficult to do, to not try to fall into the same pattern of other Black history textbooks, to try to make it distinct, all the while being told by various interviewers and, you know, consultants and stuff, that I'm the next Isabel Wilkerson, as though Isabel Wilkerson isn't around writing books right now. And I have a completely different writing style and we're not the same people, even though we wrote about the same subject.
Yes, we can, in fact, have more than one book on the topic.
It's really not allowed unless it's about Pearl Harbor or World War II. We have to have only one book on the subject.
I didn't realize this until you were explaining the approach, but you mentioned specifically with the lynching and just having the illustration of the noose. When my daughter Pippa was reading the book, she's 12, she actually brought that page down to me and was asking how it, for lack of a better, she was like, how did this work? Like, what does this mean? Because it's not something she had encountered in school yet. And so I didn't even realize it in the moment, but I was so appreciative that our first conversation about it could be so nuanced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. As a deliberate result of being so particular about the illustration.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also a highlights the real collaboration, because the imagery is paired really well with the text, and that it offers further conversation and opens up that honest interaction you have with one another, but also with, I mean, that we are having right now with you, Blair. And I think that that is a unique quality to really good, specifically really good nonfiction, because nonfiction can be really intimidating. And I think that it's really important, especially for young people, to be encouraged to read nonfiction in a way that is really approachable.
I think also it's like the job of nonfiction authors to not be so dense in their writing, not be so intimidating. Because like, yeah, there's a lot of clout and prestige in making something hard to read. But what's the point?
Exactly.
It's harder for you. It's harder for people. Like, but there is so much intention in making things inaccessible. Because if you grow up in the projects and you're the kid named Brandon that I mentored who lived across the street from me in Brooklyn, and you only see one vision of what America wants you to believe Black people can do, and then you never learn about redlining, you never learn about the GI Bill, you never learn about mass incarceration or the war on drugs, but you see all the symptoms of it, you're going to believe what American curriculum and governments want you to believe, which is that suffering and poverty are characteristic of being Black. And that's not true. It's characteristic of being oppressed in America as Black people, but that's a distinction that must be drawn out. And so I'm so frustrated by people who write the great American novel, who write things like, you know, 10 reasons you should break up with your smartphone, an imperative text on how social media is destroying the world. It's like, okay, yeah, great. But the TikTokers who need to see that, the Instagram kids who are being affected by body dysmorphia because of filters, do not have access to that. You have to meet people where they are if you, you know, really want to impact things. But that's what I've learned in publishing, is that sometimes people just write to write. They write to get on lists. They write for their own motivations, which is valid for them. But they do it under the guise of wanting to change things for the better. And that dishonesty is what frustrates me, not only with publishing, but in a lot of the work that is done, whether that's nonprofit, et cetera.
I love that. And I'm just thinking about the way in which you approach the information that you want to people to know. And we watched your TED Talk in preparation for this interview. And I'm gay, I identify as gay. And I was just so struck by your honesty, as always. Especially having grown up, that you say you grew up in a religious home, but that you grew up in a home that you felt really safe exploring your identity.
I think that there's so much that goes into coming out that is so just bewildering and dishonest. Now, it's not about, the dishonesty isn't about you living a lie. I think that's a big like narrative that's told, like, oh, they had to live a lie, da da da. No, nobody is out here being dishonest. People are forced to conceal parts of themselves because we live in an oppressive society. It's not hard to be gay. It's not hard to be trans. It is hard to be those things in an oppressive, homophobic, transphobic society. You know, those are the things that are important. People ask me, oh, it must be so hard to be Black and queer. No, I wake up and I'm myself. That's the easiest thing to do. You know, boom, I'm me. Yeah. But it's the effects of those things, people receiving me in negative ways based on their nonsense. And so the onus is not on us as queer people. The onus is on folks who make it impossible for us to exist, some of whom are queer, because we have to remember that oppression isn't just perpetuated by those outside of us. It's also perpetuated internally. And so coming out isn't a one-time thing. And I used to make fun of that episode in Degrassi where I think it's Marco comes out on accident on stage to his father in the audience. And it's like, boom, now everybody knows he's gay. Yeah. The end. That's so not true. You come out at the doctor's office. You come out to your new friends because it's not to say that it's there's also that narrative that it's because, you know, gay people love attention. And it's like some of us do. Hi, me. But some of us are you know, recluses. Some of us are very private and introverted because we're a group of people and there's no one way to be queer. But it's because this idea of being able to be your full self with people is something that we have experienced rejection around. Regardless of how positive your upbringing was, it's still the concern that people won't accept something you don't want to and can't change something about yourself, you know? And so for me, I was expecting a Marco moment where I sat my mom down. I would tell her that I was a lesbian and she would, you know, set off fireworks and then everything would be great, ABC Family style. But one, I'm actually bisexual, which my mom helped illuminate for me in the, you know, it fit.
I love that part.
But also it's never going to be a picture perfect situation because the only person who can validate you and your queerness is you. And that also means that you coming out, you know, for the people who aren't out, who are, et cetera, the validation has to come from within. Because if you invest yourself in what others think of you, you will be disappointed because it will never match up with who you believe yourself to be because they aren't you. And so those things are really what I think outness is about, you know, and it's also a privilege, you know, it's a privilege in so many parts of the world, including the United States, to be able to say, this is who I am. This is who I love. This is my gender. This is how I live in the world. And for that to be the end of the story. Because there's so much hegemony, there's so much bias, so much forms of oppression. So when you find a way to internally validate yourself, then it makes it just a little bit easier for you to get through the day, for you to remember, I matter, I'm important, I'm valid, outside of people telling you that you aren't. Because that's what resilience is, that's what power is, or that's what power can be. And so when we make coming out all about the person who you are coming out to, instead of it being about the experience, then we miss the mark because then we start making it about these so-called allies instead of making it about our own community. But we could have a whole conversation about that. All the straight allies that get get awards. Meanwhile, queer artists are pushed to the sidelines, or queer authors.
Struggling.
So there's just so many things. But fundamentally, coming out is a lifetime process that is about people and systems making it so that you can be your full self in the way that people who are not marginalized are able to do. It's not about keeping something to yourself. Sometimes it is because you want to, but more often than not, it's because you have to survive. And that's what we need to shift.
Wow. I have learned so much today. It's one of those things of even... We talked about it. You're always in the process of learning things. And one of the things that I just so appreciate about your style, Blair, is that it's so approachable. And I don't know, I find it easier to learn and be open to learning new things because of the way it's presented.
Yeah. I mean, if something's like, hey, here's all the ways you can learn, and this is a safe environment for you to learn in, versus it being like, hey, like I remember when I took an art class, to go off on a tangent, and the art teacher was like, we don't use erasers here. And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm going to make mistakes because I'm a human being and I don't want to have to live with those mistakes. And that I felt like was such a toxic style of teaching. Now, some people might say it's because you have to learn to roll with it and it's a great life lesson. Not at 8 years old. That is a high stress situation for no damn reason. You know, taking a timed test will make you averse to math if you are not good at math and you're under a clock. It's been shown. Other students feel like they can really accomplish things, but it becomes competitive. It becomes difficult. So learning, you know, it's something that everybody has the capacity to do, period. But we have to be able to make people comfortable to step into that because learning is vulnerable. You're having new formations imprinted upon your very lobes in your brain. That's massive. You know, you're making new neural connections. That is intimate. You know, that is something that should happen in a safe, loving environment, especially in formative years. And so that's how I approach it as a whole body, not just as an intellectual practice or a thought exercise.
I love it.
Me too. This has been such a joy, Blair. We cannot thank you enough for making the time for us today. We are, like I said, we're joined today by Blair Amani. We hope everyone goes and picks up copies of her book. They are Modern Her Story, Stories of Women and Non-Binary People Rewriting History, and her latest book, Making Our Way Home, The Great Migration and the Black American Dream. Both titles are available in our retail space if you're local to Cincinnati. But if you're not, please buy through us anyway. We are at bluemanatee.org. You can find Blair all over the internet. She is on Instagram at Blair Amani or at her website, blairamani.com. And do not forget, every one of you, if you purchase a book with us, we are able to donate one to a child in need in Cincinnati. And we would love to be able to say that we donated books because of these two books written by Blair Amani. Thank you so much, Blair.
Thank you. Have a lovely day.
You too. So let's talk about Blair a little bit.
Oh my gosh. It was so hard not to like fangirl.
Yeah. Well, we did.
We did.
Yeah.
We failed. I so enjoy her work just in general. And I, you know, I've been following her on Instagram since the beginning of the year and the book came into the store. And now she's doing just these amazing, I love the Smarter in Seconds. I love, she's just sharing so much information and just really using her platform in such an interesting way and reaching a huge cross-section of people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just excited for her. I just really enjoy her work. And so it was such a treat to talk to her.
And you know what? And something that you and I had texted about a little bit after the interview and something that my husband, after the interview, my husband asked, how did that go? And I was like, she was amazing. And she said something about being a woman, therefore living a life as a public speaker where she has to assume she's about to be interrupted. Mm-hmm. That really, really made me really reflective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I it's the same.
Yeah.
And she, I think she said something about, you know, especially as being a Black woman. And I was like, yep, because the sentiment 1,000% resonated with me.
Yeah.
I constantly feel in professional situations, not so much at our specific bookstore because it has, we have a lot of women on staff.
Yeah.
But when I go to conferences or I'm in larger group meetings in the industry, I'm constantly interrupted.
Yeah.
And I know that, I mean, as a Black woman, it has to be worse for her. And when she said that, I just hadn't really thought about it. It's just so a fact of my being that I didn't, I don't know.
No,
I was like, oh my God, you're 100% right. That absolutely happens to me like every day.
Right. And I think that says a lot about, she mentioned how because of that, she's become a pro at getting to her point in a way that she knows, no one's going to cut her off. And I think that that is what made Making Our Way Home so readable to me, because she said, like, there's something really bizarre about the nonfiction world where it's like this really intimidating sector of reading. Mm-hmm. And she writes so concisely and to the point, and she is that way as a public speaker too. Like, she just, like, she doesn't bullshit, and the reading experience is the same way. And so I felt so comfortable consuming this information that I had never read before.
Yeah, it didn't feel intimidating or overwhelming. I kind of likened it to, like, I really like watching the Crash Course videos YouTube or as you and I are both aware, I fell into curly girl TikTok, curly hair girl on TikTok this summer.
Yes.
But it's all sort of the same. And you take this information that maybe you formerly would have read about. It's nonfiction, it's instructions, and it presents it to you in a different format so that all of a sudden you feel capable of.
Yes.
Yeah. And she just does it amazingly well.
And it's kind of to, what did she say? The Apple what? When I was saying, like, I'm kind of mad about this, like the.
Oh, yeah. She said it's like Apple Care. You know, you think everything's going to be covered and then nothing is.
Right. And that was so clever and true. Yes. Like, but her book and her writing, I think what makes it so powerful is that it suggests conversation. And I was doing so much Googling outside of what I was reading. I was just like, I cannot believe this person is in history that I've never heard of. And I just spent so much time Googling so many people that she was writing about. And I think that, you know, this keeps happening to us on our podcast. We interviewed Blair like 3 days before Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away. Mm-hmm. And we're recording this conversation when news has hit that, like, basically Trump's going to have the votes he needs to elect a new Supreme Court to replace her. And these timely things keep happening around when we do interviews with people who are doing work around mm-hmm. almost around the situation that we're in, and it feels really odd and I don't know, kind of otherworldly, because Blair is a historian, and so much of her job is to educate and teach us about the past. And it makes me actually really hopeful for the future of history, because of the history we're living through right now, that someone like Blair is going to be the person who is letting everybody know exactly what happened.
That's a really interesting insight. I hadn't thought about it that way. Because I know she would know all kinds of interesting things about this.
Yeah.
I was reflecting on, you know, she talked about the way we teach history and how, yeah. you know, we talk about slavery and we talk about the passage, and then we have a whole bunch of history, and then we have the civil rights movement. It's like the next time you see Black Americans in our history textbooks.
Right.
And then again, they kind of fall off. And then you get to now and you're looking at all of the Black Lives Matter protest and you're sort of like, what's the problem?
Right.
And I was so glad that she addressed that, because I was sort of feeling like, I was just wondering myself whether that was part of the issue with what was going on, because I think a lot of people are just under the incorrect impression
yeah.
that the civil rights movement happened and now everything is great.
Right, exactly. We have movies about it. Look how much yeah, farther we've come.
It's not part of the ongoing dialogue.
Right.
And in the same way that I guess people during the civil rights movement thought, well, slavery's over, what's the problem?
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought her perspective on just saying this is a part of history that we need to learn more about and be more aware of, and we need to be aware of what's happening now, because it's informing not only our present, but also what's going to happen in the future.
Jill, that was very lovely.
Every once in a while, like, I hit one correctly.
No, you always do. I couldn't respond because I was ready for you to keep going.
Can I tell you one other thing? Please. I wanted us to talk about today?
Yeah, of
you
course.
And I both watched her TED Talk in preparation.
Oh my gosh.
And she said this line that you and I were both, we were kind of watching it simultaneously in separate places and texting.
Yeah.
You and I both, I mean, it's like the text message version of a gasp, but she said, she was talking about when she told her mother she thought she was a lesbian, and her mom said, no, sweetie, you're a bisexual. But her mother said, we don't reconcile identities in this household. Wow.
Yeah. Fuck. What is it? Live, laugh, love.
That's what I said. I said yeah. to Michael, so many people I know have like on some kind of reclaimed piece of wood, like live, laugh, love. I want on my reclaimed piece of wood, we don't reconcile identities in this household. I don't think they carry that at Hobby Lobby.
Well, definitely not. I mean, isn't Hobby Lobby? Well, we'll go to Michael's. Michael's will help us.
Exactly.
No, I thought her TED Talk was so moving, because especially because yeah. like she also just because it's so fun to watch her speak. I mean, she's so mm-hmm. commanding in a really, again, a really deeply approachable way. Like I would love for her. I'm just genuinely really excited about her future and excited for her, because I think she said in March or April she had like 50,000 followers, and mm-hmm. at the time of recording she had like 270,000, which was like
amazing.
5 months later, 6 months later, like she's going places. I'm really excited that we've genuinely loved these books that she's had since they came out.
Yeah, I hope people who listen to this episode order or come in the store and pick up her book, because it is, I know it can seem a lot like when we interview authors, you know, we're gushing or we're excited about the book.
Yeah.
And I was talking to my husband about this the other day, and it's genuinely because we read books and like them and then reach out to the author. And so when we're interviewing someone, it's because we're enthusiastic about
it. Yes.
And it's the same with this. I am excited to get her work into the hands of more people.
Yeah, because make no mistake, Jill and I read a lot for work, and a lot of what we read, we don't like. So we are not bullshitting you when you hear us loving a book on the podcast.
I'm pretty sure we've made that clear.
Okay, cut. Nope. Too many times I've there's one in particular, I'm sorry, I will never bring her up again. So, you know, we work for the Blue Manatee Literacy Project. So, and you know, and having listened to this podcast, that for every book you purchase, we donate one to a child in need in Cincinnati. And I just, like I said to Blair, I love the idea of us being able to donate books because someone bought these books. And I think that Jill said this in our on our Instagram stories, and we said it in the interview, like, these are so approachable. These books are so approachable for all ages. I think especially approachable to adults, because many of us as adults grew up deeply insecure about approaching nonfiction. And this is just a really great avenue into reading more nonfiction if you're interested. So please visit us at bluemanatee.org if you're interested in purchasing the book. Follow us all over social media, because you're going to hear about updates from us on Instagram at Blue Manatee Books, Facebook, Blue Manatee Literacy Project and Bookstore, Twitter, yeah, Blue Manatee Books. And don't forget to follow Blair everywhere.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you've got a book recommendation for a person who enjoyed Harry Potter, The Da Vinci Code, Racing in the Rain, and Cosmos, by all means, hit us up at that email address. We're eager to hear.
We are desperate. And it can't be Angels and Demons. Jill, this was yet another interview that you set up and reached out to make sure happened. So thank you so much for doing it. It was an absolute joy.
Thank you for indulging my whims. I had a blast.
Yeah. Bye, everyone.
See ya.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast. If you're interested in learning more or donating to the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, you can find us online at bluemanatee.org. If you're in Cincinnati, come by and see us. We're located at 3094 Madison Road in Oakley.